The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 719 for Tuesday, July 24th, 2018. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show that takes all your questions, tips, cool stuff found, some adds in some of our own tips, some of our own cool stuff found, mixes it all together, makes it fun, makes it entertaining, makes it informative, and makes it so that the goal is that each and every one of us, including us, me and John, your hosts, we all learn at least five new things each and every time we get together. That's how we define success here at Mac Geek Gab, and we have fun doing it. Our sponsors for this episode include a couple of new ones and a couple of returning ones. Masterclass at masterclass.com/MGG gets you a free 7-day trial to a really cool place where you can learn from the best in the world. We'll talk more about that in a minute. 1Password.com/GeekGab gets you 3 months free of my favorite password manager. LinkedIn.com/MGG gets you $50 off towards your first job posting. If you're looking for talent, LinkedIn is the place to do that. And crossover from CodeWeavers. If you go to CodeWeavers.com/MGG, you get 35% off after your 14-day free trial, which you also get at that same link. We'll talk more about all of those things in a moment here, back here in Durham, New Hampshire. I'm Dave Hamilton.
And likewise, back here from a mini vacation event in the Chicago area, but now back here in Fairfield, Connecticut, this is John F. Braun.
How you doing today, Mr. John F. Braun?
Good, good. As I just mentioned, was at the Mac Stock Expo out in Chicago there. Got to hang out with all the Mac cool kids pretty much. Yeah, it'd be terrible if something bad happened at that event. The Apple podcasting ecosphere would take a major hit.
Yeah, it really is kind of in a sense, certainly has a lot of the best Mac podcasters there. It's almost a Mac podcasting event, and that's where its roots are, right? You know, Mike's a podcaster, and obviously, And Barry Falk, big fan of podcasts, and the two of them are sort of at the core of what brought it together, even though, you know, Mac Stock itself is just Mike's event. But really, I love that conference. I was sorry to have had to miss it. It seems like every other year it coincides perfectly or imperfectly with family travels for me. But I'm hoping to make it next year.
And I even learned a little something.
That's what we do, right, man? That's great. Glad
in
to
many
hear
of the sessions. I think the biggest the thing that was totally new to me that I knew about but I hadn't looked at, but I think I will. I'm not sure what I'll do with it, but markup.
Markdown.
Markdown, sorry.
That's okay.
But there was Adam Christensen did a thing on Markdown, and actually our friend Brett, one of the other people there actually writes a Markdown parser, which is cool. And, we got to do some hands-on with that. It's pretty neat stuff.
It is neat stuff. Yeah. We use WordPress internally here for all of our stuff and for publishing Mac Geek Gab, but also for publishing all of Mac Observer and all of that. And on the back end, you know, you can use Markdown, the back end editor supports full Markdown, and I think at least one of the authors here writes in Markdown. For those of you that don't know, Markdown was created actually by John Gruber, the guy who writes Daring Fireball and does that podcast, The Talk Show. He created it a long time ago as a way of having, he wanted something that wasn't HTML, but wanted the ability to write and inform formatting, right? So that if you want to do something in bold, you wrap stars around it. If you want italics, you put underlines around it. And there's, of course, far more to it than just that. But that was sort of the idea for Markdown, was something that could be read as plain text, but also then formatted by a parser automatically to create, formatted, stylized text. For articles on a website like, Mac Observer, in his case, like Daring Firewall. So that's where Markdown started. And now it's very, very widely adopted. As you're finding. Yeah, it's a pretty cool thing. And it's really easy to wrap your head around if you're doing that type of thing where you're writing a lot, that is built to then be published on the web. Markdown is very, very much worth your time to consider. It's way better than writing in, say, Microsoft Word or Pages, and then trying to copy that into a WYSIWYG editor. And what happens is you inherit all of this weird font stuff and everything that just gets in the way. And Markdown keeps it all very clean. So,
and it's all text.
And it's all text, right? That's right. Yeah,
which exactly. Technically,
you so could, is HTML, but
you could stylize your So, for example, if you want to make something bold, I think in HTML you would do left thing slash B would something like that. But so it makes it even simpler in that you shouldn't have any parsing problems.
Well, and it makes Markdown is far more human readable. Like if you took a Markdown version of an article, you could read it as a human, and it would make you'd be able to comprehend it a lot easier than you would something with that had HTML formatting wrapped all around it. So, yeah, coolio. All right, let's. We've had a bunch of follow ups from the last couple episodes. As you probably know, we recorded the last two. Over 2 weeks ago, and then released them while John and I were both sort of traveling. And we have a lot of follow-ups here. We had a discussion about capturing text from the screen in an image and then converting that to actual text. So if an image has some text in it, what can you do with that? And we had so many of you write in about how to address that. And so we'll start with Neil. Neil says, I'm in the middle of the podcast, but I think that these links might be some help. He says there is an app called Condense at condenseapp.com. And of course, on the App Store, which can perform OCR on the text contained in a selected area of the screen. I have used it in the past. The OCR is not, in my experience, fully reliable, but it still might be of benefit for the writer looking to have the screen read to him by performing OCR on parts of the screen. Very, very interesting. So thank you so much for that, Neil. That's great. We will put that link in the show notes as we always do. Any thoughts about that, John, before we move on to Greg's comment about the same kind of thing?
No, not really. No, most of these all are just, really clever ways of extracting text from an image, which is somewhat of a complex.
It's non-trivial. That's right. Yep. And these things all make it trivial. Greg says, I'm blind. And I use OCR software all the time. He says, I use an app called Microsoft Seeing AI, which allows you to grab text from a photo or basically anything, and it reads it out to you in real time. It also allows you to scan documents and save them. It reads currencies, too. It does a lot more other things that assist the blind and the visually impaired. Thank you so much, Greg. That's what a cool app. And it's available for free. We put a link will be in the show notes for you, but, very cool.
From Microsoft.
I know, man. Yep. Yeah. They have smart people at Microsoft, which is no great surprise. We give Microsoft a lot of guff because, Windows, but there's really smart people doing cool things there, just like there are at a lot of companies. Along the same lines, Ev the Nerd writes in and says, I am dyslexic, and this is what helps me read all the time in terms of having the iPhone read non-selectable text inside of accessibility speech in settings. You can turn on speak screen. That will speak all the text on the screen. So then all you have to do is scroll and zoom to the body of a web page you want it to speak and swipe down with two fingers, and it will start speaking the text. I use this constantly, especially when the admins of the church I work for send out the notes of their meeting, and I have to read the whole thing to get a couple of sentences that pertain to me. Now I can do this when working and have my hands and eyes free to do other things. So very cool. So that's not coming from an image, but that is just allowing it to kind of do that. You know, you can select text on iOS and choose speak, but a lot of times web pages aren't easy to select. The way Safari renders things on the page can make it very cumbersome to quickly select something and choose speak. So this works very, very well. So thanks, Ev. Thanks, everybody, for those. That's great. That then brings us, John, into the scanning world, which starts to get also interesting, and we'll jump to Elliot to start us from there. Elliot says, in show 718, you asked about on-the-fly OCR of text from images. I use one of two apps to do each of these perfectly. One is Prismo Go, and the other is Text Grabber from Abby, A-B-B-Y-Y. And so there you go. That will OCR the images that you've scanned in. And of course you could take a screenshot and that then becomes a scanned image, just like something you would have scanned. So lots of great stuff here, man. Any comments on this before we keep going, John?
No, Abby. Yeah. I think Abby gets bundled with,
ScanSnap, I think.
Yeah. I've seen it bundled with various scanners. So,
yep.
So yeah, whenever you get an image scanner, be sure to look at the goodies they throw in there, because they probably will toss in something that'll do OCR for you.
Right, that's true. Yeah, I hadn't quite thought about that. Neil, I was trying to think if he had something. Yeah, he said he talked about, in terms of scanning book pages, there was the whole cookbook scanning thing. Right, which we'll get to here. A couple other people have comments about it. But he says, in terms of scanning book pages, there's a scanner from ScanSnap, the model SV600, designed for scanning book pages, and which claims to perform distortion correction to deal with the curve on the pages from the binding. He says, I've not seen it in operation, so I can't vouch for its function, but it might be of use to people looking to scan books, especially cookbooks. But it's not cheap. He says it's currently on sale from Fujitsu at $895. So there you go.
That I think is the one that I recall seeing at a show. The only thing I don't think it does is it will not flip the pages for you. I think you still have to, you have to have someone do that manually.
That's a manual thing. That's right. Yep. Yep. For sure. For sure.
I'm thinking I'd almost want to build a contraption that would flip the pages.
Yeah, good luck, man.
Be a fun little project.
Yeah, like deciding how much pressure to apply to pull any given page, right? I mean, if you think about it, like when any of us sit down to flip the pages of a book, right, it just happens automatically. We don't even think about it. But if you do stop to think about it, think about like the amount of physics that your body and brain are applying to that process. It's intensely complex, right? Because if you put too much pressure on, you'll bend the page. If you put really too much pressure on, you'll get four pages, right? You just want to get just enough to lift that page and go. And of course, we all know that sometimes our hands are too dry, so you need to, you know, wet your finger, but again, don't wet it too much, otherwise you'll soak the page. You just want enough to get some, you know, a little bit of friction. It's that would be quite a thing to build that could do it universally, right? If you knew the thickness and weight of the pages that you were pulling, and not just thickness and weight, but also the texture of those pages, because some pages are shiny and require a different approach. If you knew that going in and could eliminate those variables, that would be interesting. But otherwise, right? Am I crazy? I know.
Oh, no, yeah. You're not. I just had an image in my head. Is could you train Hector D Bird to do that? And I would imagine it's possible, but I think more than likely Hector would destroy the book.
Hector would destroy the book. Yeah, Hector loves to destroy books. Hector is an African gray parrot that has lived in the Mac industry for all of her 20... Oh, gosh, how old is she now? 24, maybe? 24 years. So, started with Ambrosia and then took kind of an interesting and circuitous path and has wound up with us. And the plan is that she will remain with us for either the rest of her life or the rest of ours, whichever comes first. Parrots tend to live or can live a very, very long time. So, yeah, interesting. All right. Sticking with this, why not? Bill says the best results can be had using an open source program called Scan Taylor. This is for the cookbooks thing, and it's available at code.google.com, and I'll put a link for that, and also scantaylor.org, scantaylor. Over the past few years, I have scanned hundreds of books and thousands of pieces of sheet music and have found that ScanTaylor is essential to getting good, clean pages. ScanTaylor does things like split pages, deskew them, darken text, lighten backgrounds, add margins, eliminate speckles, set DPI, and generally clean things up. Once you've got clear images from ScanTaylor, you can convert them to PDF and even OCR them using software such as Abby's Fine Reader. And again, that's ABBYY, PDF Pen, DevonThink, and Adobe Acrobat Pro. There are many options in this space, including open source programs and built-in automator actions. Whatever PDF/OCR programs you use, ScanTaylor is the secret sauce that makes your PDFs look good. You'll also get better OCR from text images created by ScanTaylor. So thank you. Yeah, and he says there's a lot of help for book scanning at DIYBookScanner.org in the forums. So we will definitely put that link in the show notes, which of course I'm doing right now, which is why I have to pause when I speak, because, you know, we humans are not actually good at doing more than one thing at a time, despite our misconceptions to the contrary. Pretty good, huh, John?
Mm-hmm.
All right. One more free option and then one more very specified option before we move topics here. Patrick, along these lines, says, in regards to converting images into text, although this is not an on-the-fly solution, the solution I use to convert images to text is for the purpose of having my Mac dictate the text to me. I use an online OCR converter called Free Online OCR at free-ocr.com. That converts the text in an image electronically for me. I sometimes take it further and convert the text into an audio file that I can play later. You can create automator scripts to do this for you in the Mac, but there are other online services that have even better naturally sounding voices. I use another online service called FromTextToSpeech.com that uses the George voice, or at least the George voice is the one that he has chosen. So FromTextToSpeech.com. I don't know. That's where it is, right? Good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. And then Harvey comes up with perhaps the most specified answer that we have seen to this. He says, you were asking about the way to scan cookbook index pages. He says, but wait, check out eatyourbooks.com. They've already got them scanned and you can search them online. You can even search a database with 5 books of your choice for free. There's a fee to search additional books. Then all you need to do is open your cookbook to the page number indicated online. Bon appetit. So when there's a will, there's a way. I like it. That's good. Thanks, everybody, for all your tips on that stuff. That's it's crazy how much, like, we've gotten more. I didn't read half the comments that we got about this, but yeah, good stuff, huh, man? Right? Good.
Yeah, you know, I think in the back of my mind, I was remembering that Google was doing something with OCR.
Okay.
I actually came up with something here. Google's OCR software now works.
Yeah, is there a link or anything? I'll put a little placeholder in the show notes.
Yeah, I'll have to look more into it. I'm not sure about the availability. I know it created a
okay.
was it them or Amazon? I think that somebody was OCRing books.
And, oh, and Amazon.
All upset.
Amazon, you definitely, like, I find Google searches pointing me, like, deep into books at Amazon all the time. Yeah. And I can see where people would get, you know, mildly upset about it. They do it. They display it in a, I think, a mostly useful way. You actually see the scan of the book page, and then the text there is sort of keyed to the words that are in it. So you can, you know, kind of go through and find, and it works really well. At least the little bit that I've used it. But I think it's cumbersome enough that you wouldn't want to read a book that way. And I don't know if there's a maximum number of pages or something that stops you there too. So, yeah. Hey, can I talk about two of our sponsors at the moment, John?
Please do.
Awesome. Our first sponsor for this episode is a new sponsor, Masterclass, at masterclass.com/MGG, where you can go to get a free 7-day trial of this awesome place that has courses taught by, like, brand name experts in their fields. Imagine learning new recipes from Gordon Ramsay, right? That's one of the things you can do at masterclass.com/MGG, or photography tips from Annie Leibovitz, right? That's what Masterclass does. Online classes taught by the best in the world. And as you would imagine, when you're working with the best talent in the world, you're also working with the best cinematic production quality. And they have on-demand lessons loaded with exclusive content that you'll only find on Masterclass. Malcolm Gladwell on interviewing, Ron Howard on collaboration, astronaut Chris Hadfield on traveling to Mars, right? And new classes are always being created and added. So whether you're, you know, checking something out for a hobby or expanding your skill set for your career, Masterclass has the classes for you. Really, really cool stuff. So like I said, check it out. For a limited time, you get to go to masterclass.com/MGG. You got to check this website out. It's so well done. I mean, like, just it really blew me away. You know, we're so used to this kind of, and there's nothing wrong with just, you know, sort of homegrown video classes and stuff, right? But it's very different. When you get to go to masterclass.com/MGG, you get a free 7-day trial. Learn from the best in the world at masterclass.com/MGG. Again, that's masterclass.com/MGG. Our thanks to Masterclass for sponsoring this episode. Our second sponsor for today is 1Password for the Mac. It's really actually 1Password for the Mac, for iOS, for Windows, for Android. Go to 1Password, the number 1Password.com/geekgab. It's a little different. This is a password manager, right? And you need a password manager. You can't use the same password everywhere. You know that. We talk about this all the time. 1Password is my favorite password manager. I've tried them all. It's the one that I always come back to after I test something new. They keep adding new features. They've got a thing in the new version that will check to see if your passwords, if any of your passwords are on the lists of passwords that have sort of leaked out into the world. They don't share your passwords with these lists, of course. They download the list to your computer and compare it there, but it works out really really, really well. You got to check this out. You need a password manager. Go get 3 months for free of 1Password at the number 1Password.com/geekgab and make it really easy to use different passwords everywhere, sync them everywhere, and just make your life safer and easier, right? 1Password is one of those rare things that adds both security and convenience simultaneously. You can't not use it. 1Password.com/geekgab for 3 months free. Our thanks to the folks at 1Password and Agile for sponsoring this episode. All right, John, Shall we move on here? We have some more tips. In fact, I have an audio tip from our friend Allison, who I think you saw this weekend at MacStock. Relating to our UPS discussion.
I've learned almost everything I know about UPS is from Dave Hamilton. And living out in California, we don't really have a huge need for them, but I do find them very useful, and I have one. And I wanted to make a recommendation to people buying a new one, a recommendation that Dave himself might never think of as a necessary recommendation, because he never experienced what I experienced with mine. We've had one for quite a while. It was run from CyberPower. It was pretty old. It was maybe 8 years old. And my 2-year-old grandson walked into the room where it was, and it happened to be at eye level to him. And so he reached up and he hit the power button. So down came all of my Drobos and my my router, everything. Oh, it was just a big mess. And about an hour later, he did it again. Well, shortly after that, my UPS died, and we figured it was as old as it was, it probably wasn't worth replacing the battery. So we ended up getting a new one. We got a CyberPower 1500 volt amp unit, and it has one very, very important feature. You can't just press the power button and shut it off. When you press the power button, you have to hold it down for like, I don't know, 10 or 15 seconds before it'll shut off. So my recommendation when choosing a UPS is that it not have a power supply that you can shut off with a single button, just in case you have wee ones running around your house.
Yeah. So her advice is great. And I wish I had had this advice about 13 and a half months ago, because Allison listens to a lot of Mac Geekab, but she must have missed episode 664, which we titled Puck Killed the Wi-Fi, because Puck, our cat, killed the Wi-Fi by doing exactly the same thing. He stepped on the button and then he did it again. So now we have a bottle cap taped over the button of that UPS that we can flip up and turn the UPS off or on if we so choose, but Puck cannot step on it to turn it off. So yeah, the newer ones, actually she said she got a CyberPower, but the link she sent me was for the same one that I use in the office, which is the APC-BR-1500G, I think. And that one, as she said, you have to hold the power button down for a not insignificant amount of time before it will turn off. That can be a very handy feature. You don't want these things simply turning off willy-nilly. The whole point, in fact, is that they do not let things that are plugged into them get turned off willy-nilly. So, yeah, good advice. Tape over the power button if it is a, you know, one tap and it's off kind of thing. So,
mm-hmm.
Go ahead, yeah?
I'm saying, so at least to make it childproof, put it above child level.
Yeah.
Like maybe put it in an elevated position, though I don't think that would work too well with a cat.
Mm. Yeah, it wouldn't have mattered. This one, the one that Puck was turning off is on the floor behind the TV, and that's also where our cable modem was. I keep going back and forth with having the cable modem at the house versus here at the office. Now the cable modem's here at the office for different reasons. But yeah,
now that I think about it, if I had to design something that could not be easily turned off, I'd almost think of doing something like kind of like the nuclear launch. Nuclear missile launch thing.
Yeah,
where engaging one device doesn't perform the action. You actually have to engage at least two devices in the case of, you know, or at least what I've seen in the movies, you need two keys from two individuals to agree to. So I'm wondering if, you know, designing one with two buttons that, you know, a child may be able to figure it out. The cat, well, maybe the cat could figure it out, too. I don't know.
Yeah. But you're right. Something that can't happen accidentally, certainly, is a good thing. Yeah. Like Control-Alt-Delete, right? Keys on opposite corners of the keyboard. So that,
yes.
Yep. Ah, fun stuff. All right. This is simply just a cool thing that Gene sent in. He says, open Google Maps in a browser. So maps.google.com, select the satellite layer, hold shift. Now, I'm going to warn you before I tell you how to do this. Gene sent this email in. I was in I got home from vacation, had a lot of your email to go through, and I lost 10 minutes after reading Gene's email, because this was so cool. So open Google Maps in a browser, select the satellite layer, hold shift. Then click and drag on the map in the screen and watch as it rotates into a controllable, zoomable 3D view. He says it works great in the mountains as well as for buildings in bigger cities where oblique information has been gathered. He says, I'm not sure when this cool stuff was added. Maybe it has been there for a long time and I just found it. The view is very similar to what Google Earth and Google Earth Pro, which Pro is now free, have been offering for a long time. It is cool. Not everything has this, as he calls it, oblique information. Some cities do. Some areas do not. I actually wound up driving the map up from my house to the lake where my son is at camp. And it's a lake I know very, very well because we vacationed there many times as well. And there were some edges of the islands that were obviously not rendered quite right. But that's very nitpicky. I still lost 10 minutes driving around in there. It's pretty, pretty cool. So yeah, there you go. Thanks for sending that in, Gene. Had you seen that before, John? Is that new to you? Are you now lost in this?
I tried it when I was going through the agenda. Tried it earlier today. No, it's a, it's kind of like you're in a little airplane flying over a train.
Yeah. And you can change your altitude. Like, that's the cool part is you can, if as you zoom in, you get closer in on it. Yeah, it's very cool. Very, very cool.
Though, you know what I have to try, and this is something that's interesting to do with Google Maps for a lot of places. There's certain things that are fuzzed out because they're sensitive.
Really?
I think the last time I looked at Google Maps, that's the reason I went there. It's like, let's look at this. The White House, I think at one point had the top, blurred out because there's secret sensors or something there. Military installations, all that fun stuff. Yeah, I think if you try to go to certain places, you may not get a full resolution rendering of it.
Interesting. Interesting. Cool. Huh. Very, very cool. In 718, we talked about backing up your Synology, and that got us into a discussion about various cloud services, specifically the ones that were supported by Synology, but just other cloud services too that you could back up to. And I mentioned one called Hubic, H-U-B-I-C, that I'd been using and was telling you about it, John, because I suggested maybe you should use it because I think they were giving 25 or 30 gigs free of online storage, and I was using, and I still am using that. Unfortunately, as Seth informs us, Hubic is now closed to new customers. It really wasn't their core business, and it wound up growing faster than they than worked for them. So they will continue to support it for any of us that had signed up prior to whenever they did this close, but it is now closed. So sorry about the potentially misleading comments in the last show. It's they are looking for someone to take over that business, but my guess is if and when they do that, the kind of the free deals will change as you would expect. It was almost too good to be true, I think. And in fact, maybe it was. So there you go. Thanks for that, Seth. And sorry about that. I was traveling, John, as you know, and we were in many cities. We were in Las Vegas. We were in the Los Angeles area. And then my wife and I went up to Lake Tahoe. Just kind of bouncing around the West Coast. And I've learned when walking around in cities, especially with my phone where I need to be looking at maps or whatever, I like to have a good firm grip on my phone. And in the past, I've always used handle cases, H-A-N-D-L, because they've got it's a very flat handle on the back that you kind of slip your fingers into, and then it really kind of snugs that phone up on your hand. So you can really trust that even if you lose your grip for a moment on the phone, it's not going anywhere because it's sort of wedged between two of your fingers with the way this case is. As we were prepping for this trip, I realized I did not have a handle case for my iPhone X. So I went with plan B, which was I put a pop socket on my iPhone case. For those of you that haven't seen it, and I think if you're not a teenager, you might not know what a pop socket is, but they seem to be growing in popularity. They are an adhesive, it's a little disc essentially that you, a telescoping disc that you adhere to the back of your phone. and then it can flatten almost to the, you know, to the, to your case. But then you pull it out and it creates this little telescoped thing that serves the same purpose. You kind of wedge it between your, I wedge mine between my index and middle fingers on the hand that I'm holding the phone with. And it does sort of the same thing as the handle case. And then you can kind of wedge it. To me, the UX of the pop socket isn't quite as good as the handle case, but of course it works with any case. And I happened to have one, which meant that, you know, the day that I was packing for the trip, it was like, oh, right, got this problem solved. And there you go. And much to my surprise, John, when I got home, I tried wireless charging, Qi charging with the pop socket on there. And it actually still worked. I was able to charge my phone with the charger in the car, through the pop socket, even though it added, you know, quite a bit of thickness to it. It still was enough.
Well, what's the material?
It's plastic.
Plastic.
Yeah.
No, you should be able to get through that. No, yeah. I think you'd have issues. Yeah. If something's metallic, I think is the only way you'd have, if there's any sort of metal, then that would certainly, break the induction.
Right.
Mechanism there.
Right.
Yeah, any
right,
other material, sure. I think it should be able to get through it. Though you bring up a good point is that, you know, if it's too far away,
right,
you know, if the case is too thick, that may also,
yep,
at the very least, impact the effectiveness of the signal. You may not get full charge if it's too far away.
Exactly. So, yeah, but it's a cool thing. Really, you know, I'm always worried about dropping my phone, especially walking. And, you know, using directions like in city streets, I'm always worried about, you know, getting jostled or, you know, bumping something and then the phone drops. And that's always a bad scene. So cool. Todd has a little quick tip. I suppose I could have found a way to put this in our easier ways to see stuff on the screen segment earlier in the show. But really, it's quite separate from that. Todd says, often on my iPhone, there are apps or screens where I cannot zoom in. He says, what I do in those cases is I take a screenshot. Then, because of the way iOS 11 works with screenshots and it puts it in the lower left corner, I just tap on the image in the lower corner and I zoom in on the screenshot. He says, note that you have to zoom out if you want to move to another section and zoom in. But the nice part is after, you know, he says after he zooms in, he clicks done and it offers to save or delete the screenshot. So he's not left with, you know, his photo library littered with all these screenshots. He just deletes it when he's done after he's finished zooming in. Nice little tip. I like it. There have certainly been times where it's like, what does that say? Or I want to read that better. And doing a screenshot would solve that problem. So thanks, Todd. Good stuff. Fun, huh, John?
Oh, okay. Yeah. Makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. I'm categorizing this as a tip, though it certainly came in as a question. Listener Alan wrote in asking, he says, and the tip is, I didn't even know you could do this. So, you know, sort of a double layer here. He says, prior to High Sierra, I could right click on a dock icon of an app, and within the options section, it would show a menu, including the option to assign to this desktop, which allowed me to specify, for instance, that I want mail to always open in desktop number 4. So if you are running mission control, is that what we call it now in High Sierra? Right? Yeah, mission control, where you can have multiple spaces running, right? Then you can have apps automatically launch into specific spaces. Now, you have to have those spaces created. There's many ways to invoke mission control. The most common one with a trackpad is you swipe all 4 fingers up on the trackpad, and then that will sort of bring down the mission control bar, and you can add a desktop with the plus sign in the upper right corner. And then you can do this thing. His problem is that even though this still is supposed to work in High Sierra, for him, that option simply wouldn't appear even when he had multiple desktops open. He said, I was messing around with it one day and I did see it appear, but it's not consistent. And most of the time it's not there. So we found that by going into System Preferences, Mission Control, and then unchecking displays have separate spaces, that turned the option back or resurfaced that option for him. The question, and I'm still waiting on a reply on this as of, at least as of the last time I checked before we started recording, the question is if now unchecking that box or rechecking that box would also leave it. Is it just a scenario where it needed to be turned off and then on again, as so many things can be in macOS these days? It's worth remembering, just from a troubleshooting standpoint, that all that happens when you make settings changes in the UI, you know, especially in system preferences, is it's writing a new entry or replacing an entry in a plist file in, you know, usually your preferences folder, but it could be anywhere that the system uses. Sometimes those files can get corrupted. And when you change a setting, it's rewriting at least a portion of those files or that file, and that can fix a problem. So that's why a lot of times, you know, turn the setting off, close system preferences, reopen system preferences, turn the setting on, or vice versa, can solve problems. It's not voodoo. It's just, you know, sort of a way of very meticulously and surgically dealing with that corruption. So there you go. That's right. Did I get that right, John?
As far as I know.
Cool.
One way to do it. It's another version of turning it off and on again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, you know, it's nice to know why these things work. And then that one seemed like that solution seems to work on a lot of things. And I think that's why it's just like, okay, yeah, something in the file, you know, an end parenthesis or an end semicolon or an end bracket got lost somewhere. And so things aren't being parsed right and yada, yada, yada. You could go into the file and edit it manually, but unless you know what it's supposed to look like, it's very hard to do that and guess correctly. Not impossible, but you have to have some sense of whether it's actually wrong or not. Whereas flipping the switch, it's already hard-coded into, say, the system preferences app, what that, or the preference pane in this case, you know, what to write to that file or what to change in that file. So it's a safer bet. If it works, and often it does. I finally get to use AirPlay 2 in my house now, John, thanks to Sonos. And this is a pretty cool thing. I found myself last night, you know, we were in Tahoe, of course, seeing the band Phish, because Lisa and I like to do things like that. And we, you know, we get... Now, we used to get, with our ticket purchase, we used to get streams, we used to get downloads of the show. And sometimes it's fun to listen back to a show you were at, especially if it was a good show. Now, though, they've changed it, and we don't get the download for, quote-unquote, free with our ticket. We just get the ability to stream it, and only to the app on our phones. So I was like, oh, I really want to kind of listen to this while we were making dinner last night. I'm like, I want to listen to this while we're, you know, while we're making dinner on the Sonos in the kitchen. And the thing is, our kitchen Sonos is not one of the models that supports AirPlay 2. But we have a model in the house that supports AirPlay 2. We have several, but in this case, the new Sonos Beam that we just talked about recently supports AirPlay 2. And so what I did was I AirPlayed from the Live Phish app on my iPhone to the Beam. And then from there, I was able to do the multi-room thing and pair the Beam with the speakers in the kitchen. So I had the music coming out of both places, which is actually what I would have wanted anyway. And then boom, I was, you know, streaming from my phone. So even though the speakers in the kitchen don't support AirPlay 2, once you have one speaker that does, that can be the gateway, and then you know, and then it uses the Sonos stuff to magic to stream. So AirPlay 2 is pretty cool, man. Being able to select multiple speakers right there and do all that stuff. It's a pretty good UX, and I'm pretty sure Sonos is the first company to really have that running on non-Apple hardware. So it's pretty cool. Very well done. So kudos to everybody, Sonos, Apple, everywhere that worked to make that possible. But the nice part was, here was this app that I don't think's been updated, you know, but it supports AirPlay and supports those frameworks. And so iOS was like, yeah, of course, if you support AirPlay, then you support AirPlay too, because that's just how, you know, the frameworks work. They get expanded and you don't have to do anything different to your app. We'll take care of it from there. And it just worked. It was like, hey, I can solve this problem now, which was great. So cool, cool stuff, man. We're living in the future, my friend. No,
I'm not.
You're not living in the future?
I'm living in the present. How can you live in the future? It's impossible.
I don't know that it is. I really think this whole time as a linear construct thing is just something that
overrated.
I think it's necessary, right? I mean, our not just our feeble human brains, but our human bodies are very temporally rooted, right? So we really can only experience time in this linear thing, but I don't think time is linear like that. I think it's sort of exists. You know,
depending on what you're doing, time can certainly seem to accelerate or slow down.
Mm-hmm. It's true. And we can only experience one moment at a time, right? We can't really, like, you know, like I said earlier, our brains just aren't built to do more than one thing at a time, even though we try to trick ourselves and think that they are, you know, or to focus on more than one thing at a time. Obviously our brains can do multiple things. You know, we're breathing and our bodies are doing all these amazing things, sort of on autopilot. But in terms of our focus, it really is just one thing at a time. And so I think because of that, you know, we can't think about all of time at once. You know, we have memories. That's our way of experiencing past times. So I don't know.
Or you could live in the past.
There's a great Jethro Tull song about that, man. I'll put a link to, I've always liked that tune. Jethro Tull's an interesting band, man. But anyway, I'll put a link to that. So, hey, can I take us to our second round of sponsors here, my friend? Is that okay by you? Cool. Our next sponsor is LinkedIn. At linkedin.com/MGG, you'll get $50 off your first job posting. You know, the right hire can make a huge impact on your business. And that's why it is super important to find the right person. I can tell you stories of, you know, detrimental things that have happened for me and our businesses over the years by hiring the wrong person. You've got to hire very, very carefully. But it's hard these days to find people, right? It's always been hard to find people. It seems like it's even harder now. And so you kind of want to look for people that are looking for a job, but you also want to look for people that aren't necessarily looking for a job. And where are all of those people connected? LinkedIn. Think about it, right? They've got a leg up on everything because people that aren't looking for jobs are also engaged on LinkedIn and making sure their profiles are up to date and all of that stuff. You know, people go to LinkedIn every day to grow professional and some people, of course, discover new job opportunities there. 70% of the U.S. workforce is already on LinkedIn, and LinkedIn Jobs matches people to the role that you need based on more about who they are, their skills, their interests, and even how open they are to new opportunities. That way your job post gets seen by the right people. Most LinkedIn members haven't recently visited job boards, but 9 out of 10 are open to new opportunities, of course. So you can only reach these people on LinkedIn. So check it out. Go to linkedin.com/MGG and get $50 off your first job post. Again, that's linkedin.com/MGG to get $50 off your first job post. One more time, linkedin.com/MGG. Terms and conditions apply as they always do. Check it out. Our thanks to LinkedIn for sponsoring this episode. Crossover from Code Weavers. Look, if you go to codeweavers.com/MGG, you get a 14-day free trial of Crossover. And it's a cool, really cool thing, right? Because it lets you run Windows apps on your Mac without needing to muck around with Windows. What were we just talking about earlier in the show? You know, we said Microsoft gets a bad rap. They make some cool stuff, but why do they get the bad rap? Windows. Because Windows. I mean, why do you want to run Windows? But sometimes you have to run a Windows app, or sometimes you just want to run a Windows app. Maybe there's a fun game you want to play and it's Windows only, or it runs better via the Windows version. Well, check it out with Crossover. Go to codeweavers.com/MGG, download your 14-day free trial, and you get to just run the app. You don't, not only do you not have to run Windows, you don't have to buy a Windows license. You don't have to mess around with, you know, Windows virus protection, none of that, because it just runs the app without having to run a Windows environment around it. It's not even that it hides the Windows environment. It literally isn't running it. It's just sort of translating the frameworks in there using some crazy voodoo. It's actually using something called Wine, but it's not an emulator. It's just doing all this translation. You got to check it out. And if you've tried it in the past and it hasn't worked for you, never fret, because the folks at Codeweavers have made massive changes recently. Crossover for the Mac 17 is their most powerful version yet. Not only do you get the 14-day free trial when you go to codeweavers.com/MGG, you also get 35% off of a one-year subscription of Crossover for the Mac. So go check it out. Again, that's codeweavers.com/MGG. And our thanks to the folks at Codeweavers, not only for sponsoring the episode, but for making Crossover and continuing to make it so much better. And it's always so much better than Windows. Thanks. And there we are. All right, John. Let's see. We've got... You want to take us to Robert, my friend?
Let's see. I think I will take us to Robert.
Awesome.
There's Robert.
Well, cool. Hold on. Mm-hmm. You want me to talk about a quick cool stuff? Okay, you got it. All right, good.
No, we're good.
Okay, cool. I know I'm jumping around the agenda a little bit, so yeah, cool.
All right. So Robert says, I know you probably hear this all the time, but my 2010 iMac is running slow. Just switching between this email and an open Safari app gives me a beach ball. I went to System Preferences and did a startup item request, and this is the list that returned. And he has Alfred 3, Keyboard Maestro, Text Expander, DD Assist, which is a Drobo thing, Default Folder 10, Mail, and Amazon Drive. That seems pretty minimal, actually.
Yeah, it does, yeah.
I know these apps take up resources, but I can't believe they should slow my system down so much. I have a feeling there's more running than just these. Well, yes, there is.
Right.
I've checked Activity Monitor, but A, I don't know what I'm looking at, and B, the only CPU hog seems to be the kernel task, which takes up about 8% of the CPU. And then the next large item is com.apple.speechrecognition, core.speechrecognition, which takes up 863.4 megabytes. All right. This one is a 2010, and I have installed 16 gigs of memory, and I have a 500 gigabyte SSD. I am also using Ethernet directly from the iMac to the modem, and speed test says I'm getting 254 megabits down and 23 up. I am stumped. Does this seem right? Is the only answer to buy a new iMac? And I would say no. Now, while the 2010 iMac is now considered a vintage machine, vintage being that Apple will no longer repair it for you, but you can still use it, it doesn't look to have the specs that are too far off from what I have, Dave, my oldest machine, which is a MacBook Pro mid-2012.
Okay. Yep. Fair. Yep.
And it sounds like he's done the best he can to get it to a point where it's not going to be resource constrained by RAM or SSD or disk, and then he has an SSD and 16 gigs of RAM, which is what I have in this machine, and this machine does not slow down.
That's a good amount of RAM. I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to be choking on that. So, right. And it doesn't sound like he's running a ton of stuff.
The beach ball is interesting, though, right? Because that means the system is waiting for something. Right. Like, it doesn't throw the beach ball immediately when, you know, an app needs to go read something from the disk or use the CPU for a while. But it will throw the beach ball after a few seconds of, oh, OK, this is going to take longer. So we better tell the user we're aware. Right. That's what the beach ball means. So.
Right. I mean, the only thing I would suggest you look at. So this one thing occurred to me in the back of my mind here is you want to make. One cause for a beach ball is if you're starting to do a lot of swapping. Yep. What's swapping? Swapping is when the system runs out of RAM, chip RAM, and needs to use the hard disk.
Sure.
To replace RAM, and because the hard disk, even an SSD, is much slower if there's a lot of swapping or moving of stuff between RAM and the disk, you're going to get that beach ball.
I agree.
Now, the way you could tell if this is happening under at least the current OS, I would say probably the best thing is you want to look at the memory pressure. And I think only if you're in a state where memory pressure is I believe the bar will turn. Normally, it's one. I'm looking at the iStat menus version of it right now.
Yep.
But I would just look at that value. If you have something that's experienced what's known as a memory leak, in that it runs out of control, and it could be the OS. I've seen this happen before, where a kernel task all of a sudden is taking up gigabytes, and it's like, well, that's not right. Or some other tasks. So you want to make sure that something is not consuming all of your RAM, because then you're going to get into the swap situation, and you will see that beach ball. Other than that, Dave, I'm suspecting it may be something filthy like a cache, which is either corrupted or there's something wrong with it. So the first thing I would try that can get you out of this situation here is something known as safe boot or safe mode.
Yeah.
And there's a handy dandy article called Use Safe Mode to Isolate Issues with Your Mac. And they even say if after running this, so it cleans up some cruft and rebuilds some things. And as they say in the article, you could read it. If the problem goes away, it must have cleared out some cache or directory issue. Beyond that, the other tool that I would use to further clean things up beyond the safe boot or safe mode would be to get our pal Onyx. If you go into the maintenance section of Onyx, they have several rebuild and cleaning options. So maybe that you got to rebuild something or clean it out in order for it to be recreated or rebuilt, and then you'll be okay. Other than that, Dave, I think, 2010, that's a good run, man.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, for sure.
I mean,
sure.
It's 8 years old. I mean, but I looked. I mean, the specs of it aren't terrible. I mean, I think it has only SATA 2.
Yeah.
And it's a, you know, but it's a multi-core gigahertz processor, so.
Yep. Yeah,
that's what I got.
I'm running a couple of, I'm trying to think if I'm running. Yeah, I think I've got two 2010 iMacs running in the house, and I don't have 16 gigs of RAM. I think I've got maybe 8 in each of them, but I've got SSDs, and I don't see this kind of slowness. Where I see it slow down is when the CPU is pegged. I run iStat menus on them, all my Macs, and it's a great way to know what the what's going on, where the bottleneck is, right? And I can see, okay, you know, when I boot the Mac, Dropbox goes nuts for a long time because it decides it has to re-index everything, even though that seems to be overly obsessive, and you know, other things moving up. And honestly, at some level, I like the fact that I see the CPU as being fully utilized, because it means there are no other bottlenecks, right? Like the disk isn't the bottleneck. I've got an SSD in there. And actually, once it was when I put the SSD in years ago into that I first saw the CPU really start to get pegged on sort of normal operations. It's like, wow, this thing's been slowed down by the disk for so long. And that's why we've all moved to SSDs, because of that. So yeah, but I don't see those kinds of beach balls all the time. It sounds like a RAM issue, right? From the way he described it, moving between apps takes forever. So I think heading down that path of looking at what's using RAM and is it swapping, like you said, you know, where it's sort of writing something out to disk so that it has room to read something else in. With 16 gigs of RAM, though, that's a pretty tall order to fill that up for a sort of a daily use machine. 16 is, you know, I would say 8 is enough. 16 is, you know, you got some wiggle room there. So yeah, I'm not sure. You got to look, right? You got to look at what's running, what's using your RAM. kernel task you mentioned can be one of those weird things, John, because many apps will load their resources in a way that they in Activity Monitor get assigned to kernel tasks. So if kernel task is bloated up, it means something, but it doesn't necessarily mean that there's a problem with the system on your Mac, right? It might just be that it's obscured a little bit. And while we're on the subject of kernel task, although it's tangential to this, potentially, kernel task will also artificially report that it's using your CPU if the system has decided that it needs to throttle your CPU for, say, temperature issues, right? If your CPU gets too hot, the Mac slows it down. And the way that it sort of addresses the fact that it's slowing it down is it will assign some percentage of the CPU to kernel task so that that's not available to apps that are actually going to use it. So kernel task can be a little bit misleading if you treat it like every other app and look at it and say, why is it doing all this? Well, it's special is really what it comes down to. So yeah, I like your idea about Onyx. That's, and Safe Boot. I mean, both are doing similar things in cleaning stuff out. If you've cleaned up the system and you're pretty confident, and especially if you see that it's lots of processes running that are using up, you know, CPU resources and sort of stealing those from you, you'll see a lot of MD workers and MDS store that are doing, Spotlight. Then I think taking a look at AppTamer from St. Clair Soft would be the answer there. AppTamer will throttle processes down to leave room for other processes, and that can be a handy thing too. So that's,
and finally,
yes,
as suggested by our good friend Brian Monroe in our chat room, which you can always attend at macgeekgab.com/stream, Brian is suggesting, and actually I'll go with this, it could be bad or flaky RAM.
Definitely. Yeah. Yep, for sure.
I mean, normally when you start up your Mac, it does what's known as a power on self test. And if the RAM is like totally shot, it'll make some beeps and say, yeah, your RAM's shot. But if the RAM's like marginal, you know, or if it's having problems reading from or writing to RAM, it may be in a state where it's just really trying and it eventually succeeds. But because it has to try so many times to eventually get it right, that may cause a slowdown. So if you can get, maybe try to reseat the RAM, or maybe try getting some other RAM. I don't think the RAM for that machine is terribly expensive.
Yeah.
No, it's a good one. I had not thought of that, especially in the days of, you know, when RAM was in sockets and stuff like that. If the RAM wasn't seated properly, you could run into odd behavior.
Yeah, for sure. Sure. Yeah. No, I like that. Yeah, it could be bad RAM. That would definitely, you know, cause those kinds of that kind of symptom if the system is, trying to read or write data to a RAM socket that's bad or a RAM chip that's bad. It could definitely slow it down. It could also just crash the system. That's the symptom I've seen more often with bad RAM, but anything's, hardware is one of those things. When you've got a hardware problem, the symptoms are never consistent from machine to machine. It's just like, however it manifests there is how it manifests. So
yeah,
that's interesting, man. Huh? So much stuff to think about. I like it. All right. While we're on the subject of slow, let's go to Perry here, John. Perry writes, I have a 2017 iMac 27-inch Retina 5K, 32 gigs of RAM, internal Fusion drive, but uses an external 1 terabyte SSD connected via Thunderbolt as the startup device. He says, on startup using the SSD, it takes from 45 seconds to 3 minutes for the Apple logo to appear, at which point everything proceeds normally. I've made sure that the startup disk is selected in the startup disk preference pane. I have zapped the PRAM and I have reset the SMC. I've disabled all startup items, etc. I've run Drive Genius and all other disk utilities known to man, and no problems are reported on the external SSD. The internal Fusion drive starts up a little faster when I use that, about 30 seconds to 1 minute for the Apple logo to appear. Everything works fine after startup, but since my 2015 MacBook Pro starts up and I see the Apple logo almost instantaneously, I thought I would ask you guys if there is anything else you might suggest that I can try. So this is an interesting one, Mr. Braun, because the app, it not much happens before the Apple logo appears, right? The system does what you mentioned, its power on self-test, and then a few things because it's got to begin loading the operating system, but that's it. Then the Apple logo appears and boot sort of continues, but there are a few things that it does. And you can take a look at least some of those, and it, regardless of what you see, the when you see it can help inform you just as much. So I would try booting in verbose mode by holding down Command V at startup, or there's a terminal command you can type setting the NV arguments to always boot in verbose mode. But that will... In a normal scenario, things in verbose mode will fly by so quickly, and I'm going to warn you in advance, they will be so tiny on your retina screen that it's going to be hard to even read it. But if the system is hung for a very long time, well, then you might be able to see what it's hung on or what messages are being reported in this verbose mode. What you're seeing in verbose mode is all of the Unix console messages that come up during boot up. And it, like I said, it's going to be totally overwhelming unless it hangs somewhere. And then that can be really informative. And if it's too small, let's kind of combine a couple of tips that we've had in this episode, take a picture and zoom in on it. And you might be able to see, you know, use your iPhone or whatever, take a picture of the screen. And we've even had some people video with their iPhone of verbose boot so that they can then go back in and step through the video to see what's happening there. But with your issue being that it's slow, you might not need to step through at all. You might be able to see it right there. I would try it. You know, you've tried a couple of things. You've tried booting from the internal drive. You've tried disabling startup items. You've tried resetting the PRAM and the SMC, all things that, you know, immediately sort of came to mind to me when you, when first reading this, but try unplugging all of your external devices, including your external SSD, right? Because
you beat me to it.
Sorry,
I was gonna
man.
Say, unplug as many things
yeah.
that you can, but and let the machine still boot. So maybe just have the network cable in there. But, you know, I'll and any
you shouldn't need a network cable to boot, right? I mean, just power. I mean, you can boot a Mac with just power. You don't even need keyboard and mouse. Very quickly, once it boots up, right. It'll say, okay, like, we need to talk. But yeah, just power. And if that's faster, then start plugging things in one by one and see what it is that's slowing it down.
Because it could be, yes, it could, there could be a discussion between the computer and a peripheral, and they're just not getting along. And eventually... it just throws up its hands and says, okay, I can't deal with you.
Yep.
But if you remove it from the equation, then it'll blow past whatever. And it could be USB. It could be, yeah, who knows?
Who knows? Right. But it should not take that long to get to the Apple menu the Apple logo. But the first thing that you mentioned here, Perry, is something we should all remember. And that was, the first thing he says was, I have made sure that the startup disk is selected in the startup disk pref pane. This is a very important thing in solving this particular problem, because if your Mac does not, if you go into startup disk in the pref pane there and you don't have something selected, what that means is that your Mac will have to go through and scan all of your disks and make a decision about where to start from. Whereas if you have a startup disk selected, and it will say it now in High Sierra, when you go into that pref pane, it will say you have selected macOS 10.13.6 on the disk. Well, my disk is called Veered Blues because I name all my disks after Miles Davis songs. But like that will be, it will be not uncertain at all that you have selected a startup disk. And you want to make sure you have one selected. Otherwise, your Mac sort of has to scan everything and guess. And that will take longer for the Apple logo to appear. And you will sort of be stuck in that limbo mode for a while. The fact that this is happening even with the startup disk tells me maybe the Mac is waiting for that startup disk to come online, right? He's got this external drive. Maybe there's something either about the disk or the enclosure or the Thunderbolt cable or, you know, whatever, which is why then resetting SMC and PRAM makes sense, because those are the things that when it's hardware but not hardware can often fix the problem. But he's tried all those things, so we don't have the magic answer here. But just from a troubleshooting standpoint and for us to all learn at least five new things, these are important steps to have taken. So I think it's probably, hopefully it's an external device and not something with the motherboard, John. Because it shouldn't take 3 minutes for that to happen, I don't think. So.
Sounds right.
Right? I mean, you know, should go pretty quickly. Especially on that machine. I mean, that's a relatively new machine, 2017, right? It's pretty good. Pretty good. Pretty good. All right. Where are we on time here? Yeah, you know, my sister and her fiance, Kristen and Jose, pinged me yesterday and asked me, John, they said, is there any way to plug my iPhone into my TV? And they were looking to plug their phone into an older TV that doesn't have HDMI, which sort of made for an interesting concept. If your TV has HDMI, sort of the easiest ways to do it are an Apple TV, right, for your iPhone, because then you can AirPlay stuff and you can either, you know, AirPlay from within an app, or you can even do screen mirroring so you can see your phone. A less expensive alternative is to get a Google Chromecast, and many iOS apps will let you cast, quote unquote, which is their word for, you know, their analog to AirPlay, but will let you cast to a Google Chromecast that's also plugged into an HDMI port on your TV. But that doesn't solve this problem. And so the problem was, okay, or the thought was, all right, well, how do we do this with a cable? And near as I can tell, John, I couldn't find anything that would go from a Lightning port to a component or composite video port directly, right? You can get Lightning to HDMI, no problem. Although there are some issues with that, as I'm finding out, where some apps won't do HDMI, you know, Lightning port streaming, like Netflix. There's a lot of Lightning to HDMI adapters that Netflix won't pass data across. I guess maybe there's some security concerns or whatever that people could, you know, copy the content or something like that. So, but you can do that, but you can't, you know, I haven't been able to find any cables that go to, you know, either what they call component, which is really RCA coax, or composite is RCA over a single coax. Coax over a single RCA, and then component, which is the three HD, you know, RCA ports. So you need an HDMI, you need a Lightning to HDMI cable, and then a box that will convert HDMI to composite or component video. And I found one of those at Amazon for like $33, $32.99 for those of you that like to be specific about those things, and it will do either. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes, but it's a Muso. It has 163 reviews with 4 stars and will do either of those things. So I'll put that in the show notes. Any thoughts on this, John? Seems like from the chat room, Brian Monroe saying, you know, as the setup that Apple uses for their keynotes, I'm sure is custom and not available to the public. I think that's right. And Warren is saying component to HDMI converter or a new time capsule. But Brian Monroe comes up with something that that I had not yet mentioned, which is buy a first gen Apple TV, because the first gen Apple TV has component video ports on it, and whereas the all the newer ones have HDMI only. So there you go. Any thoughts on that, Mr. Braun?
Yeah, that's that kind of warms my heart that they're trying to use older video technology.
Yeah, right. I figured you'd appreciate that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, the first thing that occurred to me was Apple TV, which is what I do. So I just AirPlay it to
right
my iOS device to my Apple TV.
Yep.
And,
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. Warren in the chat room correctly says that the first gen Apple TV is as useless as a TV without HDMI because Fixed on 66 says the first gen Apple TV doesn't have AirPlay. So this solution would not work. Yeah. Yeah. So much for that. I forgot about that. Really? The first gen Apple TV doesn't have AirPlay, huh? Huh. That's, I guess that's right. Huh. I didn't even think about that. Huh. I wonder why not. Maybe it's because it doesn't have... Does it have HDMI? I can't remember. Let's look. I'll pull up the specs. I'll put these in the show notes, too. Apple TV first gen. It does have an HDMI port, but it does not support AirPlay, huh? Okay. I'll believe you. That's bizarre. Huh. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Very interesting. Very interesting. All right, moving right along here. You know, John, we'll go to Yanis, because this is an interesting discussion. I think we'll probably wrap the show here, and we've got lots of others for next week's show. Yanis says, my beloved 2011 MacBook Pro died a couple of weeks ago, and it needs a new logic board, so it's not worth the cost. He says, and I've been thinking about its replacement. However, I've not been a fan of the previously current MacBook Pro design, mainly because of the keyboard, though, of course, this might have improved with the brand new 2018 models that came out last week. He says, I thought about upgrading in 2016, but decided to hold off due to the keyboard issues in the 2015 MacBook, then the 2017, and not much has changed, etc. I should note that an iMac is not an option, as I need a portable computer, and the non-pro laptops that Apple offers at the moment are either very old, the Air, or very slow for what I need, the non-pro MacBook. He says, anyway, briefly, these are the reasons why I'm not or haven't been keen on upgrading to a new MacBook Pro. Bearing in mind that in 2019, we might have a complete redesign, what is your opinion on waiting for a year and not longer, hopefully? And in the meantime, doing the following. Using Carbon Copy Cloner to create a bootable clone of my Mac Mini at work. And then use that clone to boot my quote-unquote work computer when and if needed at home using my girlfriend's MacBook Air. And in the meantime, using an iPad Pro at home for my everyday tasks. Is that a realistic solution for a year or maybe longer? And is booting via an external SSD like Samsung's T5 usable every now and then when I need a computer thing done at home and I want to have my work environment there to do it? So this is, as I read this question, I thought, you know, this isn't all that different from what I currently do. You know, I have a Retina iMac in the office that I use as my sort of daily driver at work all day, and it's great and all of that. But at home, I certainly don't get on a computer every day from the standpoint of I don't get on, you know, one of the iMacs that I have in the house or my MacBook Air. But, you know, once or twice a week I do. And they're slower computers and they get the job done for when I need to do something. And if I need to really do a lot, I can, you know, just walk back across the driveway to the office during quote unquote non-work hours, and then things are fine. So, but for the most part, when I'm just around the house, I'm using a 10.5-inch iPad Pro and it works really well. And I hadn't really thought about the fact that I don't really use a computer at home until reading Yanis's email here. And so I think, this is not only a workable solution, as a temporary stopgap, it might be a long-term solution where, you know, you've got a computer when you need it, but for most of the things that, you know, certainly for me, most of the things that I do, you know, an iPad is actually better because it's just easier to grab and sort of, you know, more built for that quick interaction kind of thing. Not that you can't do long interactions on it, and I do all the time. But yeah, what are your thoughts on this, John? And Warren in the chat room asks, you know, a question that really does apply. What's the definition of a computer? And of course, all of these things that we're talking about, a MacBook, iMac, and an iPad, and an iPhone, and your Apple Watch are all computers, just different interfaces and that sort of thing. So
yeah,
thoughts on this,
I think,
John?
Of that cute line in the Apple commercial where, you know, the kids using their iPad and,
yeah,
and you know, some adult says, you know, what you doing with your computer? And the kid's like, what's a computer?
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
And it is a computer. It's right. A computer without a keyboard.
Right.
That's my only thought. Actually, I saw, you know, we were driving around back to the airport, I think, and Allison, I was in the car along with Allison, and I saw her pull out her iPad Pro, and I'm like, wow, you know, if I did, at first I thought it was a MacBook, some sort of a smaller MacBook.
Sure.
I guess my only concern is that, you know, at least for me, I need a keyboard for most of the things that I do, not all of them. Yep. So maybe an iPad Pro with a keyboard would, and there's plenty of keyboard cases out there, last I checked, right?
Yep. Yep.
So, you know, and it's a, you know, it's got a beefy processor. And so I think for most things, for me, and yeah, I think the thing is my current iPad Air is not performing.
Yeah.
Well, it had to be repaired, and it does weird things every now and then.
Right.
I'm thinking the next iPad I want to get, maybe an iPad Pro with some sort of keyboard case. And, you know, try it as an experiment. The only thing that occurs to me is that, it makes me uneasy trying to force the use of an iPad to do everything, because it's not in my humble opinion, it may not be the best tool for all the things you do. So you really have to think about what type of things you're doing.
Absolutely. Yeah. 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 And,
I mean,
and
you're just like typing and surfing and emailing and stuff. It'll probably do what you need. But if you're doing, like, you know, heavy video or audio production work, though, I've seen people use an iPad to do that sort of thing. You just have to reflect on what sort of tasks you need to accomplish with each device, because you are limited with an iPad as far as what you can connect to it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And even workflow wise, an iPad you have to really be thoughtful about the path you're going to take. Right. Like the one thing that for me is very difficult on the iPad, simply because of how we do things with the show, is answering people's questions from my iPad. Right. Because when I answer a question, I want to then save that as a PDF in our shared Evernote. And I want to put it in our, working agenda document so that I don't forget about these things. And I realized that I can actually do that with a workflow, either by saving a screenshot of something and then workflowing that into Evernote and pasting it into our document, which works well, except for replying to an email, because you can't print to PDF in that way when you're composing an email. So, with that, I figured this out on the airplane, actually, heading off to vacation, where I now email it to myself at my special Evernote address, and it goes into an inbox thing that I then have to go and triage when I'm at my desk. So it's imperfect, but it's doable, and it allowed me to answer some questions while I was away. But that's sort of the point that I'm trying to make, is you have to really think about how you're going to get things done from a productivity standpoint on the iPad, whereas on a computer, it's just a little more natural to it, especially when you're trying to tie multiple apps together. I guess that's where productivity gets to be potentially cumbersome on the iPad. But you know, where he's not talking about replacing all of his computing time with iPad time. I think there's, like, again, you know, for the most part, that's what I do, and it works fairly well. So, yeah. Yeah, but you can't, like, I agree with you. Forcing your iPad to be your main computer for most of us is the wrong decision. You know, I was talking to my son about this. He's going into his junior year of high school. He's going to be doing a lot more writing. And so his older MacBook Pro, we're going to need to get him a new something. And I just said to him, I said, would a larger iPad Pro be the right thing? And he was like, huh. You know, and so we messed around with him, and he's still on the fence about it. And I think really a MacBook Pro or some sort of Mac laptop would be the right decision for him for that too. But it's just interesting kind of thinking about all of this, that it's not as straight a decision as it used to be, especially for the person that has, say, a desktop computer and a laptop. Does that laptop need to be a Mac, you know, or a MacBook, or could it be a tablet like an iPad? So, like, as the accessory computer, the iPad can work really, really well for many people, not for everyone. Keyboard wise, I wanted to just kind of throw it out there because not a lot of people know about these Bridge keyboards, BRYDGE. They make your iPad feel like a MacBook in many ways. They fold in very well. They're sturdy. It's a real keyboard that you get to type on. So I'll put a link in the show notes to Bridge iPad keyboards, but I've tested them out at trade shows and stuff. And it's been like, okay, like if I was going to do a lot on the iPad, this is definitely the keyboard that I would get. So, yeah. Well, all good things, my friend, all good things must come to an end. And
and then there's this show.
There's this show. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. But we must. Right. We must, my friend.
Speaking of this show,
yes.
If you would like to provide input to us or have a question or a tip or anything else you want to tell us, one way you can go about that is you can send an email to feedback@macgeekab.com.
feedback@macgeekab.com is what my esteemed podcasting partner here said. We had to switch today from Discord back to Skype because otherwise we weren't hearing each other. So John's audio has that Skype hiss to it today. So I think you weren't able to hear him. That's why I clarified.
Yeah, no, you're correct. And if we were using Discord, then you wouldn't have heard me say feedback@macgeekab.com.
That's correct. Or any premium listeners, of course, you can email us at premium@macgeekab.com. All of you are welcome to call us at 224-888-GEEK, which, John, is
4335.
Come check out our new forums at the Mac Geek Gab forums. MacGeekGab.com/forums is the right way to get there. So much great activity out there. I sort of lost touch with the forums while I was away, and I came back on Friday and looked, and it was like, oh, holy crap, there's like so much happening out here. So really, really great stuff. And thanks to everybody for jumping in there and helping each other out. It's what we do. We answer questions, and it's far more organized now, and we can upvote answers. And so when people come in 6 months from now with a similar question, they'll be able to find it. Oh, it's so, so cool. All right. I want to thank our sponsors, of course, sponsors for this episode that included masterclass.com/MGG, onepassword.com/geekgab, linkedin.com/MGG, codeweavers.com/MGG, smilesoftware.com/podcast, otherworldcomputing@maxsales.com. Barebones Software at barebones.com, ring.com/MGG. You all rock. Our sponsors rock. You folks rock. All of our premium listeners, you rock. Have a great week, folks. I hope everything goes swimmingly for you. We will see you next week. And between now and then, my friends, do me one favor. Don't get caught.
Made on a Mac.